Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Today, we're going back to events of the mid-1960s in California. With the death this week of Nancy Reagan, we'll hear from local author Ken Holden about what happened in 1966 when her husband Ronald Reagan was an unlikely candidate for governor of California. Later in the hour, Pamela Johnson explores the youth subculture in San Francisco and Berkeley in a story which begins in the fall of 1965. Her novel, A Nation of Mystics, is based on real events. My guest today earned his Ph.D. in clinical psychology from The Ohio State University. Ken Holden met Stanley Plogue at UCLA, and together they founded a market and research consulting firm. It was the 1960s, and their expertise was sought to help give direction to an unlikely candidate for governor of California, Ronald Reagan. When candidate Reagan became Governor Reagan, he appointed Ken Holden to the California Board of Psychology in 1968, a post which he held until 1971. Ken and his wife, Julie, moved to her native Hawaii, where he worked for the government in children's mental health. He also had an airline pilot's license and was a captain for the Royal Hawaiian Commuter Airline. When Julie died in 1992, Ken Holden moved to Chico, where he flew his own airplane and spent 15 years in the Butte County Sheriff's Team of Active Retired Seniors Unit. Over the years, he and his friend Stan Plogue talked about writing a book. Dr. Plogue died in 2010, but Dr. Holden has now written that book, The Making of the Great Communicator, Ronald Reagan's Transformation from Actor to Governor. Ken Holden, welcome.
Hi.
You know, there are so many books written about Ronald Reagan that what made you think that you could write something different about it?
Well, nobody has written a book about the transition of Ronald Reagan from a B actor to a governor. They've written about him as a president, but there's a gap in between that nobody has thought to write about. And when we started to do that, we got some feedback from the literary people saying, why didn't we think of that?
Well, you start out by telling there are three main characters in your story, and you're the only one that can tell this particular story.
That's right.
I mentioned that your associate and your friend, Stanley Plogue, died in 2010. President Reagan had died in 2004. So you were the only one who knew what happened on three special days in Malibu, California, in 1966.
And people need to know how that transformation took place. And we were there. There was three of us, Ron, Stan, and Ken. And it all devolved about that kind of mutual respect, finally. But I can go into more detail about that.
Well, if he's running for governor, how could you two guys have access to him all by yourselves?
We demanded it. We had five demands with no fooling around, and they were so desperate that they hired us as a last. They had many of the
His money. Handlers, you mean?
The handlers, no. This was money now.
Okay, so the guys that are footing the bill for Ronald Reagan to run for governor.
Like Salvatore and those Tuttle and those people, they had already decided that they might go for someone else, because he was doing such an incompetent kind of, he just didn't know what he was doing in terms of speaking out in the kind of venues that he was in and what he was trying to accomplish. Remember, it's hard to translate then to now, because the zeitgeist, if you will, is entirely different, and I don't blame people for that, because...
Well, this was really before campaigners knew that we better find out more about this. We better run this campaign a little more scientifically.
No, it was... they didn't really think that we would make a difference. And but it was,
they were about can come to the conclusion that it was a lost cause. Is
oh
that
yes.
what you're saying?
Yes.
So they said, "Well, we'll give these guys a chance,
a last chance."
Mm-hmm.
And
so they call you in, and you say, "All right, we'll do it, but." And you think these guys are not going to agree to these. The odds are really against these guys saying, yeah, we'll let you have 3 days with Ronald Reagan by yourselves and we won't interfere. So what were these five conditions under which you and Stan were going to meet with governor candidate Ronald Reagan?
We, in effect, in a little bit, you know, go to hell if you don't like it kind of thing, the campaign would stop for 3 days, flat out.
Because they were really running him. His health was poor. He was sick. And they were pushing him and pushing him. And so one thing you said is you've got to stop making him campaign for 3 days.
That's correct.
And what were the other demands?
Stan and I would meet with him, and we would meet in private where it was total isolation, no coming in from the next door and no phone calls, no nothing. And we were really adamantine about it. We just weren't going to let anything happen like that. And we got down to the end, the last one was all of this is non-negotiable. And these guys didn't like to be talked to like that. Henry Salvatore.
These are powerful, wealthy guys.
Oh, yeah.
And here are these two young behavioral psychologists saying, here's what we're insisting on. And they weren't used to being talked to like that.
Oh, they certainly weren't. Salvatore came from the oil fields, and he had big fists, and he had a tendency to not be talked back to. And I was a little more definite than my partner, but this was what we needed to do it, take it or leave it.
In fact, it seemed like you were always the one that would get your dander up before your partner would. Stan would was a little more laid back, I think, and you would get mad about things.
They were lucky that I didn't use any of my Merchant Marine language in these. We were really being a little bit arrogant about it because we didn't know what we were getting into, really. But we were going to find out whether Ron had the stuff that we could work with to help him in his
campaign.
Yeah.
So you start your book when you are invited to the Reagan's house and you get to see where he lives, and it's a very comfortable place. And he, when he walks in the room, you think, oh, wow, this guy really lights up a room. So you get 3 days, and the men who hired you found a place for you to have those 3 days just with him. And wow, what a place it was. Describe where you met with.
Well, we met with him down in Malibu, in this nice but small kind of rich man's place on the coast. And it was very interesting because Ron was expecting two psychologists to get out their tests and do all this kind of psychological stuff. But he handled it very well. He was very friendly and so on. And that's why the backgrounds of Stan Plogue and myself were so important, because we could tell him that we'd been out in the real world, and I'd been in two wars and typhoons and all of that kind of thing. And Stan had been very prominent in the music industry with his trombone. He was a first chair all over the place. And
in fact, that's the first thing you did, really, is I keep wanting to call him President Reagan. He wasn't president at that time. But Ronald Reagan wanted to hear your stories. Who are these guys I'm dealing with? And so you told him, each of you, you and Stan told him your stories and what your background was.
He asked for them.
Yes. He wanted to know who he was dealing with.
Yeah.
Because he had expectations. Just like when I started reading your book, I had some of those similar expectations. I'm thinking, okay, the guy's a psychologist, and so I'm going to start reading this book. And I thought, wow, before he ever became a psychologist, he lived a full life that several lifetimes could have been. And then when I got to that sentence, when President Reagan, you and Stan have told him your stories, I had that same reaction that Ronald Reagan had. Wow. And his word was, you guys aren't just eggheads. And I was thinking when I read it, well, they're not just academics. They've had their feet on the ground. They've had life experience that they bring to this training.
It made the whole difference, because then Ron gave his background. And by the end of the first day, pretty much, we had started to bond together.
You knew you could trust each other.
Yes. We were the three musketeers, if you will.
Well, when he told his story, and then you also tell the story of these three people who were meeting in this house in Malibu for 3 days. And you had insisted on 3 days. You said, and why three? Why 3 days?
Well, we knew that the press is always lurking out there. And we knew that we had to get to know him so we could make our assessment of whether we could, in fact, do anything.
So you needed a long enough time to get to know him. But if you took very long, the press was going to get wise to it, and they were going to start writing stories about it.
Yeah, and it was over a weekend, so we got by with it. They didn't really know. Later on, we became an object of the opposition in terms of the
curiosity. Who are those guys, and what are they doing?
Well, then they said we were mind benders, and they came on with all this pseudo kind of thing, and they never did figure it out. We were in the background. They wondered, what are those two guys doing? You know, what's this all about? You know, Stan and I'd look at each other, and we backed off. We tried not to be a factor in the campaign ourselves. It did become that later on when they started to see what we were doing.
My guest is Ken Holden, and we're talking about his book, The Making of the Great Communicator, Ronald Reagan's Transformation from Actor to Governor. And a lot of this transformation took place over this three-day weekend that you and your associate, Stan Plog had with Ronald Reagan. And it happened at his birthday. One of those 3 days happened to be his 55th birthday. And when I read that, I was surprised, because 55 seems like a young age. And I always thought of him as being an older politician. And then I read, he just turned 55 that weekend with you and Stan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You then, when you tell the stories, each of the three of you, and you start by telling Ronald Reagan's story, and what impressed you about his background?
He had a lot of, and I know this isn't the popular view of him, but he was a very intelligent man, extremely intelligent.
And that probably surprised you, too, because if you're expecting, oh, here's an actor.
We were more balanced than most.
More open-minded.
Well, open-minded, that's mm-hmm. the word. Mm-hmm. And when we told him what we were going to do and why he should do it, it was very clear that He had the talent. That's all the only thing I can think of, because he could. You had to see him in operation, but the news people never bothered to find out who he was. He was a B actor, and all of a sudden he's a governor. How did that happen? And they never looked. Even to this day, they think he was stupid.
Well, I was interested in a comic, because when he went to California, he had a date with Doris Day. And in your book, you said that Doris Day was saying that he would dance, but then she didn't really carry on a conversation. What would happen is he would give speeches. And what Doris Day said, he should be touring the country making speeches. And that, in fact, of course, is what happened. But you bring out in the book that he wasn't that good one-on-one. He was much better at global communication. What other talents did you see?
To see him in operation, he had a lot of guts, too.
You know what? That's impressed me, too, because when he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, I didn't realize that was a dangerous position.
They were going to throw acid in his face.
They issued him a gun. He was carrying a Smith & Wesson, and he had to hire a guard for his children, and that really is heartbreaking.
Yes, it was strictly amazing that these things are going on. You know, it's hardcore stuff in those campaigns.
Mm-hmm. So what other talents did you see? I remember you mentioned that he was a good judge of people, something that you couldn't teach him.
Yeah. He had a high potential for listening to people that knew what they were talking about.
Well, you said he was a good listener.
Yes.
And that impressed you.
Well, he said, why do I have to learn everything that the opposition has in their position? We said, very simple. He says, what do you mean? Well, you can correct him in his own speaking by listening. And you would be able to correct him in his own, and know more about his own position than the position people knew in their own. And it was just funny. It was really to see him, well, have you thought about this and this, and go to the next level down. At Bolt Hall, he went all the way down in this obscure law that would pass, and we had word that he was going to be checked off on that. Mm-hmm. And on an airplane going to San Francisco, we briefed him. And when he got there, and they were waiting to cut his throat, so to speak, and he got on and talked about this vague law kind of thing. And
but he didn't talk about it vaguely. It was an obscure law, perhaps, but he knew his stuff.
Yeah, well, he knew his stuff from us. See, that's what our research team was for. And then he went the second layer down that they didn't know about. And then the third went down, and they finally gave him a standing applause because they thought he was an empty-headed actor, and here he knows more about their law than they did. That's why he needed to learn the other side.
Because, you know, I thought it was interesting the way when you meet him and you wonder about, well, who are his researchers, who are his speech writers, and he pulls out a shoebox of clippings.
That was at his house. That was really pathetic, but it was also, that's all he had. Mm-hmm. Bill Roberts and those people really didn't want him to be elected governor.
So they gave him no support like you realized was necessary. And that day before you even met for those 3 days at Malibu, you go to his house and he pulls out this shoebox of clippings and said, this is how I get my information when I write my speeches.
Where are his research people? He had no backup, not even a secretary. And they were taking him to these little towns out in the Central Valley. And so if he fell on his face, nobody'd know the difference because nobody'd be listening out there. And they were thinking of putting other people in. Bill Roberts never wanted him to be governor because they had worked with Nelson Rockefeller, who was very liberal, and they just didn't like Ronald Reagan. But Stan and I were here doing the opposite. We were the second level, or the other campaign. There were two campaigns, one that wanted him to become governor, and we saw what he had, and we wanted, and we beat him.
Well, and you said another problem with his preparation is that he didn't really realize the difference in the speeches he'd been giving all over the nation and the fact that he needed to zero in. This is a California election. He's running for governor of California. And he still sounded, because he'd been traveling around. Most people know that he was a GE, a representative, a spokesman. So he would travel around the country giving speeches. So he knew what people responded to. But he was still thinking nationwide, and you needed him to focus on, no, this is what it's like to run for governor of California.
We took him to task and told him exactly what was happening, and we wanted to prepare him for the 17 or 18 main issues in the campaign so he would know them forward and backward, pluses and minuses and so on. And the other team was nowhere near as competent as he was. And we had a couple of things that how shall I put this? He forgot and blew up that one time. And
because you had encouraged him to keep his cool, and one time he just could not. He just said, I can't take it. He walked out. He went home.
And I got him back just as fast as I could, and nobody wanted him back. Bill Roberts didn't want him to go back, and everybody didn't want him to go back, but I knew. I called Nancy and said, because I knew he would listen to her, and I told her exactly what was going on. So when they came in the door, Nancy and he were talking and so on, and they said, I'm going back, and they said, no. And he says, you don't trust me. That was the key phrase that came out two or three times later on.
Mm-hmm. Because he trusted you and Nancy trusted you, the two of you could convince him the right thing to do is to get back to that place he left, even though he was mad. And that one thing could have saved his. I mean, there are a lot of places along the way that he could have not been elected governor.
Oh, yes.
So many ways it could have gone wrong.
So that's exactly right. Yes.
My guest is Ken Holden. He's a behavioral psychologist, and his book is The Making of the Great Communicator, Ronald Reagan's Transformation from Actor to Governor. And he did his own. He put things in his own words. And one of the tips when you and Stan are meeting with him and you say, okay, here's one thing you don't want to do. Whatever you do, don't bore people. And when I read that sentence in your book, I thought of an earlier sentence in your book where you described he was running George Christopher, his opponent. Mm. And Mr. Christopher comes up with a sentence like, I'm cognizant of two philosophical thoughts which perhaps pertain to this election. But, oh, boy, that put me to sleep before I could even get to the end of that sentence.
He was very quick to respond to some of the shouts from the crowd, you know, about...
Meaning President Reagan was. Ronald Reagan was quick to respond.
And he had the right kind of comebacks because he'd been around, and he could turn a thing just like that, 180 degrees.
Somebody shouts out an angry remark, and his response makes them think, well, yeah, that it is pretty funny after all. And could make them laugh and could warm them up. Yeah. And in fact, he liked starting his speeches with a joke, which a lot of speech writers do.
Oh, and you've noticed a couple of his jokes in the book.
Oh,
you know, just funny. You know, the two Frenchmen. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do. But you know what? I thought your writing was funny. And one of the sections that I thought was funny was when you describe, when you're telling your story now. First, you tell Ronald Reagan's background with GE, with the Screen Actors Guild, And then when you're telling yours, you say, okay, and it's a fascinating story itself. You, at 15, were driving a car for an electric company.
Yeah.
At 15.
You've heard of the war class.
Oh, yeah.
Well, a lot of people never knew that the young kids in high school were taking over for a lot of the people that went to war. And the war class has never gotten its due because we didn't have any adolescents. I'm exaggerating a little bit.
No, I think you're right about that. Yeah. Because you had a paper route, and a lot of young boys had a paper route. But you were responsible enough, they had you driving a car at 15. And then at 17, and you say because a mentor of yours was killed at Pearl Harbor, you and a friend of yours said, as soon as we graduate from high school, we're on our way to California. We're going to do our part. This is World War II. So you get a radio license. And you're a ship's officer at 17.
I know, it sounds improbable. But we studied when we were juniors and seniors. I had a friend, Shell Gates. And
By the way, when I say you came to California, because you grew up in Michigan.
Yes, that's correct.
And you went to school in Michigan as your high school days. And
St. Joseph, Michigan.
Yeah.
That's where we were when taught ourselves. The librarian thought I was in there studying every day after school for the high school stuff. And she didn't know that I was studying for electronics and all the rest so we could pass the governmental examinations. We had to go all the way from Michigan around to where they gave the tests in Chicago on the fifth floor, and we took all the exams there, and then we got all the other things, so we were ready to go the morning after.
So you get your diploma, high school diploma on one day, and the next day you and your friend are off to California.
6 o'clock in the morning.
And you had some amazing experiences all over the world in the Merchant Marines.
Yeah.
So you get
back. Marine. There's no such thing as a merchant marine. I'm sorry.
So you come back and you decide, oh, well, let's see. There are a lot of things I'm interested in. So you decide on psychology. And you get a position at UCLA. And I thought it was funny. They call you in to tell you why they weren't going to promote you. That you deserved it. You had all the qualifications to go from assistant professor to associate professor. But what was the problem? What was the problem, Ken?
Well, a crew cut.
Because this is the 60s now. I might remind people, this is the 60s. Not just the students had long hair and sideburns, but the professors did too.
Oh, yes.
And so, but they really didn't have to tell you didn't fit in. You kind of knew you didn't fit in. But then there was this other guy that you saw walking across campus with this big box of IBM computer punch cards. And I remember those quite well. And so you said, maybe this is a guy that feels the same way I do. So this is how the two of you opened your own business.
Yes.
But you mentioned that he also had a wide range. He could have been a musician. His brother was a composer. In fact, he could have probably made a better living as a musician than he did as a psychologist.
He could at that time. That's true. Yeah. And he went to Harvard and saw all
of
this.
Got a scholarship to Harvard. Yes.
And then he found out the training wasn't that good there.
Mm-hmm. His second year, he liked his first year. Second year, he says, oh, gosh. But he stuck it out. And at first, he could have been earned a better living at a musician. But he did. He continued. In fact, people might be surprised that the movie White Christmas, Bing Crosby, White Christmas, playing the trombone for the music in that movie was your colleague, Stan Plogue.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
So he wasn't just a garage musician. He had a successful career.
He was highly sought for a first trombone. And, yes, I won't go further than that, but he was an excellent. He joined the Air Force and Air Force Band and so on. But he was extremely talented and very industry. He was great.
And the two of you made a good team because he often, when you would get excited and overwrought, he would kind of calm you down.
Well, that wasn't quite that bad. We had temper, and that's why we were so good. We always went any place we went together, and he could handle some of it, and I would handle the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And so we had a great team going, and we were very different in personality in many ways, but it really clicked, yeah.
My guest is Ken Holden, and his book is The Making of the Great Communicator, Ronald Reagan's Transformation from Actor to Governor. And of course, when we're reading this book, we know the outcome because we know he is going to get elected. But there's this suspense of, wow, how is he going to overcome all these obstacles that are thrown in his way? And you and your partner, if those 3 days in Malibu hadn't happened, world history would be different. I had that feeling when I was reading your book, the history of the world would be different if you and Stan hadn't done what you did.
That is a fact, because it was just that far from for them dumping him and going for other people. It was that bad. And they had no idea of who we were when we came into the scene. And as I said to Stan, it wasn't for us, the wall wouldn't have come down.
The Berlin Wall.
The Berlin Wall coming down, right. And that isn't stretching it too far either.
Well, I was amused by some of the things that you called yourselves. I mentioned that Ronald Reagan said you weren't eggheads, but you called yourselves rare birds. And that was when you were talking about the fact that you were both academics and conservative Republicans, yeah. So you were rare birds. And then you also referred to yourselves once as Frankenstein sorcerers. And that was what the press might have viewed you as, Frankenstein sorcerers. And then because behavioral science was like voodoo, you also at one point referred to yourselves as evil shamans. Or no, I think that was some of the handlers that referred to you as evil shamans.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time when Mrs. Reagan, Nancy Reagan, notices that you don't have a bumper sticker on your car that says Ronald Reagan. And what did you tell her?
Well, I had to tell her that the students at the university kept ripping off Ronald Reagan's
the bumper sticker.
Yeah.
Because she made sure that everything, the decisions that were made were in his best interest. He was a real, was a real advocate for him.
Oh, when they were in that first place where I saw them in the school and so on, before they had started to run, it was very evident they were totally head over heels in love with each other all the way, and I can vouch for that.
Well, that's a wonderful point to leave on. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Ken. My guest has been Ken Holden. His book is The Making of the Great Communicator, Ronald Reagan's Transformation from Actor to Governor. After a break, I'll talk to Pamela Johnson about book one of A Nation of Mystics that recreates the psychedelic 60s. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Thank you. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. With the funeral today of former First Lady Nancy Reagan, we're looking back at mid-1960s California. While Ken Holden was helping Nancy Reagan's husband get elected governor of California, my next guest was part of a very different scene in the Haight-Ashbury. My guest today was born in New Orleans, then came to Berkeley in 1966 when the youth subculture was dedicating itself to free speech, an end to war, and the exploration of spirituality based on mind-expanding hallucinogens. Pamela Johnson is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of UC Berkeley in anthropology. She earned master's degrees in education at Mills College and English at Holy Names University in Oakland, and is a former teacher and university professor. Her first book, Heart of a Pirate, was a historical novel about Anne Bonny. She has now completed the first of a three-book series called A Nation of Mystics. Book one is called Intentions. Pamela Johnson, welcome.
Hi, Nancy. It's great to be here.
Well, your first book was definitely a historical novel, but you know, as I was reading this one, I realized this too is a historical novel.
Yes, indeed, it is.
Because you and I were living that time, so it didn't seem like history then, but now it's been long enough that it's probably ancient history, the young people now.
Well, actually, someone, I at first wrote a story set in the last century, and someone said, oh my goodness, that really does make me feel old. But yes, it is historical fiction, and very well researched as well from many, many sources.
Well, how did you start writing this? I mean, you have the information there that you must have gotten firsthand.
Yes.
I mean, you had to do some
research,
some
things,
too.
Some things that I did live through. In 1967, I lived with a man whose name was Michael Murphy, and Michael became a private investigator for the so-called drug attorneys in the Bay Area. This was a new field of law at that time. And Michael did a great many things. Among them, he investigated a group of corrupt Northern California narcotics agents. So I was at the forefront of seeing a big part of the history of this period. And there is a group of people who are agents in the story who are part of that story. About 1972, Joe Esterhaus, who was writing for Rolling Stone magazine, and he went on later to Hollywood and worked with Sharon Stone a lot. But Joe was just this sort of ordinary guy making it as a journalist. He showed up at our house one day. He was driving an old VW bus, and he was a great bear of a man wearing some army surplus clothing. But he was here to write an article called Death in the Wilderness, because the same group of agents was shooting unarmed dealers in the back, mostly cannabis dealers, and this group of drug attorneys was defending them. Michael was the person who was doing the investigation of the officers themselves. And so 2 days before the officers' trial was to come to the courts, Michael was mysteriously killed in an automobile accident. So yeah. To this day, we're not quite sure what happened, but that's part of my background. The other part of it is that I lived in the Haight-Ashbury, went on to do other things as many of us outgrew that time period, went to Berkeley, graduated. And then when I got home, I had just had my third child and thought, you know, this
now,
is...
When you say when I got home, you mean here in California, because you were born in New Orleans.
Yes. When I got home from college here in California, when I graduated, I went home and I had just had my third child. And so I decided, you know, I'm going to do something while I'm at home. I'll start writing this incredible story and started developing these characters. Well, this went on for quite some time. I was volunteering in schools. I was raising my children. I was, you know, working with a PTA and the room mother and soccer coach, everything. But in between, every spare minute I got, I wrote. And I began to notice that some of those changes that we had talked about making in the 60s were becoming mainstream. The peace movement, the women's rights in the workplace movement, ongoing public awareness of racism, emerging gay pride, populist political groups, health food stores, yoga. And this, of course, you know, because you now teach yoga in a university, which was a new thing at that time. But I also began to notice and to really understand, absolutely being an anthro major, that we had created a culture, and that culture still exists to this day. And there are ample examples of that I could give, but we'll go back to the story here. So I started writing until I had a manuscript of enormous size, put it on a shelf for almost 20 years while I went back to school and I taught and raised my family. And then one day, about 6 or 7 years ago, I decided to take it off the shelf, dusted it off. Oh, the pages were yellow. It was all typed.
I was just going to say, these were actual physical pages in those days.
Yeah, it was all typed, very yellow. And I started reading what I'd written 20 years before, and I couldn't put the story down. I was like, whoa, that is really good, but definitely a first draft. So I've spent the last 5 or 6 or 7 years working on this book, and started shopping it around, and everyone said, whoa, you know, it's a 1,000-page book. And most of the editors that I approached suggested that I divide it into a trilogy with a complete storyline, which I did. And so that brings us up to looking at the story itself. That's the background.
My guest is Pamela Johnson, and she has completed the first of her trilogy, A Nation of Mystics. Book one is Intentions. And when you realize you have 1,000 pages, that was a lot of writing.
That was a lot of writing. And my husband has watched me rewrite it like 50 times since as well. So yes, a lot more writing.
So multiply that 1,000 by.
Yes, a lot more writing. But I think any author can tell you there's a great deal of editing and rewriting and writing a novel.
So you majored in anthropology, mm-hmm. and then when your boys were growing up, you were helping the schools, and you decided you would go back and be a teacher, huh?
I did. I spent so much time volunteering in the schools, I thought, well, this would be great if I got paid for the many, many hours. I did not realize that a teacher's job was a 12-hour-a-day job, and it's 7 days a week, and maybe I would have a Sunday afternoon off, especially when you're teaching English and reading all those papers. But, so I finally wound up retiring from teaching, and that's when I really picked the book up again and started working on it.
Well, you started out, your undergraduate degree is in anthropology.
Yes.
And there's a section in your book that makes me think, there's the anthropologist in her.
Yes.
Out. And that's some research, and this comes up later in your book. But if you don't mind, would you read the section in your book where some anthropologists are doing some research?
Yes. And I will say that I worked with Michael Harner, who's part of the Shamanic Studies program here in Northern California, but I knew him when he was teaching at UC Berkeley, and then I went to New York, and I took some classes and workshops with him, and so I'm quite familiar with this topic of shamanism. So in the story, we have this rogue group of police agents who corner a young man, and they force him to betray a best friend because they threaten him with things that he cannot get past. And this young man winds up becoming part of an expeditionary team. The young man who has been betrayed, he comes back to school, he works with a professor. And this is just a brief bit about this expeditionary team going into the Amazon and what they expect to find.
Okay.
The university team had flown into Quito and from there had slipped through mountain passes in a small twin-engine plane to a missionary landing strip near a tributary of the upper Amazon. The jungle where Jerry now trekked was one of mist and wet and heat, protected from contact with the outside world by high Andean mountains in the west and the broad expanse of Amazon jungle to the east. Water from snow and rain coursed through the high-walled valleys, becoming the swift rivers that formed the waterfalls sacred to the tribes who lived in this green world. Eventually, the wild rivers left the foothills to quietly flow across northern Brazil as the Amazon. Although the history of the area was fraught with frightful stories of a warring people and headhunting, in recent years, contact with the outside world had pacified the tribes. The occasional anthropologist would find his way into the jungle to study the culture and return with incredible tales. Indians living in isolated jungle areas could accurately describe street corners in Quito where they had never been, even drawing the letters of shop names where they could neither read nor write. The natives drew pictures of people with oars or halos above their heads. Shamans gave explicit descriptions of the location of lost articles. Tales of flying were reported. All of this was attributed to the ingestion of a potion made from several vines, generally in the genus Banisteriopsis. In Ecuador and Peru, where the ancient language of the Inca was still spoken, it was called by its Quechua name, Ayahuasca, the vine of the dead.
My guest is Pamela Johnson, and she's reading from the first of a book of a trilogy, A Nation of Mystics. She's reading from book one. And that last term that you provide for us, fortunately, you have a glossary.
Yes.
So when you mention this plant,
vine.
You also tell the reader in the beginning of the book, in case they might read the whole book and discover, oh, there was a glossary back here the whole time. You have a note in the front of your book saying there is a glossary and there's a list of characters. So back in Appendix B, you tell us what ayahuasca is. And you say this is a hallucinogenic substance containing DMT derived from vines found in the jungles of South America.
Yes.
So not only about from context, but also somebody can look in the glossary and see what that is.
Well, the point of this group of characters is that the book is entitled A Nation of Mystics, and what you have is a whole generation, hundreds of thousands of the young, having these mystical experiences, this oneness with God through the use of psychotropic substances. But they are united to brothers and sisters in many parts of the world. And so the point of the expeditionary group is to look at some of these other cultures and how they relate to what's going on in the United States.
Well, in this description, I wonder, because it's fascinating, it said the natives drew pictures of people with auras or halos above their head. Is this drawn from actual?
This is actual fact. They can also write the letters of shop names in Quito, very far away, and they've never been out of the jungle before, nor can they read or write. So yeah. Yes, it's an amazing psychoactive substance. There is a great deal of use of it today. There's, in fact, a whole new industry that's going on in South America right now where people are taking these trips into the jungle to have this experience. Another cause for great discussion, but yes, happening.
Yeah, because when I was reading that, it sounds so fantastic, but I figured that it was based on actual fact that you were...
Absolutely. And to discuss the glossary just a bit, the scope of the novel is huge. It starts in Berkeley and it goes on to the Haight-Ashbury in 1967. But these characters travel to many parts of the world. So they're, one of my characters in particular grows up with a Tibetan Lama because he is raised in India of Christian missionary parents, but that's how he gets to India, and he's in school, and this is where he meets his Lama. But there are a lot of Indian terms that are in this glossary, a lot of Tibetan terms, a lot of Native American terms, and of course, many things to do with this world of psychotropic drugs.
In fact, his name is easy to remember because you give him the name Christian.
Yes, of course.
In fact, why don't we meet Christian now that you've just... talked about this character, because he's the very first character we meet on page one of your novel. Why don't you read that about this is, again, this is 1965, and this is October of 1965 in Berkeley.
With his screams still receding into the shadows of the room, Christian Brooks struggled to awaken among a tangle of sheets. Still gripped by nightmare images of burning buildings and the grasp of dark hands, he blinked and looked around the room. No longer were there angry shouts, the sound of explosions, the roar of fire. The only sound was the harsh rasp of his breathing. Safe, he slowly realized. I'm no longer in danger, but safe here in the Berkeley apartment. Rising in the dim light of dawn, he stumbled through hazy shadow and leaned his forehead against the cool glass of the window pane. The pale pink October sky was growing brighter, colors changing by the second. Still breathing heavily, Christian ran his hands across his face and eyes and looked to the street below, to movement, color, someone walking in early morning, anything to distract his fast-beating heart. Behind him, the bedroom door opened slowly. "Hey, man," Matt's sleepy voice mumbled. "Everything okay?" Just a bad dream," he murmured. Embarrassed, he was unable to control the trembling in his voice. "You want to talk about it? It's not the first time."
Now, this is a very dramatic opening to your book. And when I first was reading that, I think, oh, this is a Vietnam vet, and he's having a flashback. But that's not the case.
No, it's not.
So why don't you turn over onto the next page where Matt is still trying to get Christian to talk to him. He says, "Christian, anything we can do? I've got class in a few hours, and I've got to start getting ready for work soon. But we could have some coffee, maybe talk for a while." Go ahead and read that next paragraph.
Christian knew Matt meant well, but how could he speak of the recurring nightmare or the importance of Naresh in his life, that he and Naresh had shared almost every thought from the time he was 5 years old? How could he explain to this unworldly 19-year-old student from San Diego the poverty of India, the complicated politics of a world where religion still mattered a great deal? Matt had grown up with the Beach Boys, a surfboard, and high school dances. He had no religion, or if he did, he never spoke of it. Did he really care that in another part of the world, praying five times a day was unbroken law? That a cow was considered sacred, revered? Could Matt understand that an invasion of Tibet had created untold misery, moving a culture abruptly from a medieval existence into an unknown world, or the Tibetan belief that the knowledge of centuries had to be preserved in the lamas making their secret way over the Himalayas?
My guest is Pamela Johnson, and she's reading from her novel, A Nation of Mystics. And we've just met the character named Christian Brooks. And he has this interesting background. You mentioned that his parents were missionaries in India, and he was expected to go to divinity school and take over his father's mission. And what?
He has a chosen brother from the time he's 5 years old. And this brother of his is Naresh, but the two of them get caught up in a terrible riot one night. And this is, of course, the recurring nightmare, because things happen on that evening that he has still to put to rest.
Mm-hmm. And then later on, there's this conflict between Christian and this character named Lisa. And why don't you, this is over on page 27.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this conflict between Christian and Lisa, and Lisa has a different point of view.
Well, by this time in the story, Lisa has introduced Christian to the use of LSD. They take their first trip together, or he takes his first trip with her. She's already taken it. But then Lisa leaves to join an ashram, and they become very separate in their thinking. "I can't come back to Berkeley with you. I will miss you," she says. "But the master's teachings are very clear. Enlightenment can only be achieved without drugs. Sure, we have to change things, but it means changing our entire way of life, not just taking a chemical and using all the old elements of a decaying society, capitalism, ego, intrigue. But if you were to join the ashram, everything would be different. I could put aside my vow if I were to become a householder. Please, Christian, look into the master's teachings." The gulf that Christian had begun to sense widened. "And sit in the rose garden while millions of bombs are being dropped on Vietnam? You think people will suddenly want to make changes without truly understanding the basis of peace? You said it. Grass teaches you to think, and LSD teaches you the true nature of God."
these two characters are many characters. In fact, I counted, fortunately, you do give a list of characters in there because it yes. would be easy to lose track. I counted 59
it's
entries.
It's an epic. Yes, it's an epic.
59, epic. Although some of the characters have more than one name.
Right.
Of course, Kali is Lisa's name. And
right.
then a character named Phil is actually Ted Phillips.
Right.
But 59 characters is a lot to keep track of. So thank you for that list
thank
of characters.
You. So Lisa and Christian play out this dichotomy between them throughout the book. And, of course, you know, it all rises to a head at some point. And no spoiler alerts here.
No, we won't do that. But what people might like to get is a description of the Hate Street because it is so iconic. And you have a description in your book. Why don't you, this is on page 98 in your book. Why don't you read us that description of Hate Street?
Well, we have two young women who hitchhike out from Louisiana. School has just ended. It's the beginning of 1967. They are very, very naive and very young, 18 years old. Here they are. They've just arrived on Hate Street. They stop at the drugstore for lunch, and then...
In fact, before you read that, I read, this is the character named Richard asked Marcy, "What did you come to find?" And I was thinking, oh, I'd like to know what convinced Pamela to leave New Orleans and come to California. So I was wondering, what did you come to find?
I actually came out for many of the same reasons. I was working in the civil rights movement in the South. I was also working in the anti-war movement. Things became very tenuous there because I was in Louisiana working myself, and we were threatened quite a bit. So I came out to California just to see how California could mobilize so many people, how they were working within the political system that was going on here, and wound up staying. Yes, that was my motivation.
So you were like that, the character Marcy, who comes out and she gets asked, "What did you come to find?"
Right. Well, I'm going to read this bit on Hate Street,
yeah.
and then I'll read the bit on Marcy.
Okay.
Shortly after lunch, Richard, who the two women have just met in the cafe, ambled leisurely down Hate Street toward Ashbury, Kathy and Marcy at his side. Although it was midsummer and the sky was bright blue and filled with sunshine, the air was cool and crisp and carrying a tang of the sea salt that had come in with last night's fog. Conga drummer set a relaxed rhythm, and the walk toward his flat was slow. Richard stopped often to talk with people he knew, but the slowness didn't matter. Free of obligations and time, Kathy and Marcy stood dumbstruck while the procession of characters continued. Incense smoke mingled with the sweet smell of burning marijuana leaves. Gaping, they saw that people passed joints in plain view on the street. One man carried a 6-foot pipe openly, decorated in furs and feathers and close-strung beads. Acid, speed, lids, hawker's call, leaning easily against buildings, purple haze. Days they heard snatches of laughter, plans for journeys, road stories, and bits of information about crash pads and free food and clothing. Every few yards, someone held a hand-lettered sign with the name of a city, trying to get out of town with a ride or a hitching partner. Several people with dilated pupils and wide smiles made their way along the sidewalk, hugging strangers. Cars of curious tourists moved so slowly up Hate Street that they were practically parked, while cameras clicked out of open windows. Some of the hippies on the street flashed them a peace sign. Others offered joints to the shocked, sometimes amused occupants of the vehicles. An outrageous dude with a paisley headband and cape had set up a ladder so he could hold up a poster reading, "Better Living Through Chemistry." "Is the street always like this?" Kathy asked. The energy was vibrant, lifting her spirit and tired body. The sidewalks were filled with the young and all their palpable thoughts, with questions and answers, destinations and good times, with color and costume and selfless sharing. "Like a happening?" "Oh, yeah," Richard nodded to a shirtless man with a long red beard. "See that dude? He's from Australia. Hitched through India, up into Europe, and then met the dude with him in Germany. They hitched out here from New York." "Hitching through India?" Kathy wondered. "That couple," Richard pointed. "They're from Michigan, and her," he waved toward a very young-looking girl, "she's from New York." He turned to smile at them. "I'm from Seattle, and you guys are from the South. The Hate's a melting pot. People are here from every state in the Union and plenty of countries around the world.
My guest is Pamela Johnson, and she's reading from her book, A Nation of Mystics. This is book one, Intentions. And so these two characters, Kathy is the other young woman who has come out to California.
Yes.
Naive, and she is amazed at what she sees. And
yes.
I'm guessing that you didn't have to make this up.
No. This is something I lived through because the Haight was a remarkable place in the summer of 1967, and it's pretty much just like I describe it here. Very, very open. One of those moments in history where everyone, regardless of race or creed or color or sex, is equal and all sharing.
Well, you mentioned this was 1967 in reality, and that's what book one takes us up through the end of 1967.
That's correct.
And then you give us a little preview of book two that starts in January of 1968, and this is at the very end. This, in fact, after your two appendices, mm-hmm. after your list of characters and after your glossary, you tell us that that there is a book two,
mm-hmm.
and you want your readers to be ready for book two. So you title, what's the title of book two?
It's called The Tribe. And I think in book one, Intentions, what I do is set up why these people do what they do, why they believe what they believe, the experiences that change them, that alter them, and that, you know, help them to want to create a better world or a new culture where peace is the central point of that.
So then you call your second book Tribes.
So The Tribe is about the growing communal system that has begun in 1967. But this particular tribe of people that we're discussing here are people who are dedicated to psychedelic revolution through the passing of sacramental experiences. And this tribe, of course, has many, many people in it, and they do continue in their work. And it's with all the problems and pains and lifestyle that goes with it.
At one point in your book, you have Marcy say to Richard, "No matter what happens, I'm with you in this revolution."
Yes. Do you know what page that is?
Oh, that was page 128.
I'm going to tell you. Let's see. I'm going to go to it because it's a very good scene. He asks her, "What do you think of the acid?" Because they have tripped for the first time. And she says, and then he says, "What are you doing here in the Haight? What did you come to find?" "I think it was you, love, an ideal to live for." And that's what book one is about, the ideals of 1967.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you about your book, Pamela. The title is A Nation of Mystics. It's book one of a trilogy, Intentions. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Ken Holden, author of The Making of the Great Communicator, Ronald Reagan's Transformation from Actor to Governor. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.